Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Recently, in the last couple of years, new company listings in public markets have been a bit in the doldrums.
There just haven't been very many IPOs for 18 months, 2 years. We had a huge tech boom over the course of the pandemic. There was a lot of money invested into private tech companies that were all chomping at the bit to go public right at the moment when the market crashed. Interest rates rising, inflation causing problems for companies that don't make much of a profit, which was a lot of those private tech companies.
That's my colleague Tim Bradshaw there. And in the last few weeks, that excitement for listing publicly seems to have been potentially rejuvenated. And that's thanks to one British company called Arm. Now, you may not have heard about Arm until now, or until this IPO news, but this company has played a massive role in the semiconductor chip industry over the last several decades. Here's James Ashton on that. He's the author of a new book all about Arm.
We think about a chip as a very, very small, maybe the fingernail size, and very, very flat. But actually, chips over time have stacked up and up and up. It's the classic problem in real estate. If you can't build out, you build up. So if you're building a skyscraper or an increasingly complex device, you need a really good architect. And Arm is the architect, essentially. So the Arm secret sauce is an instruction set architecture.
Now, Arm's current owner, the Japanese tech conglomerate SoftBank, is the group that's looking to take it public.
A lot of other tech investors and bankers are watching this deal to see if this means we are back and that tech listings are open for business once again after a considerable time waiting. And there is a lot more companies wanting to go public.
The proposition sounds exciting. Arm designs chips for the world's biggest tech companies: Apple, Qualcomm, Google. Then there's the booming market fueled by AI hype. But when the company actually lists, will that translate into real success for investors? I'm Michaela Tendera from the Financial Times. Today on Behind the Money, we're bringing you a special bonus episode about the impending public listing of the British semiconductor chip designer Arm. It's a live recording from the FT Weekend Festival, which took place at the beginning of September in London. For this conversation, I invited two Arm experts to join me. First, there's my colleague Tim Bradshaw, who's the FT's global tech correspondent. And second, James Ashton, who's the author of a book about Arm that's out this year called The Everything Blueprint. We talk through what we know about Arm's position as a company right now and what all that could mean for investors when the company lists publicly this month. Starting off here, I asked Tim about Arm's recent F-1 filing. That's the document that foreign companies have to file with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission when they want to be listed on an American stock exchange. It's where companies have to share details on things like their profits and ownership structure.
So we just learned a lot about Arm through their F-1 that they filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission in the U.S. Just at the end of last month. What were the most interesting things that you learned from looking at that filing?
The number that jumps out to start with is that 99% of the smartphone industry uses Arm's products. I mean, there are
99%.
So, I mean,
who's the 1%?
I don't even know. I mean, I
haven't found that out yet.
I still haven't found that out. I mean, there is one of the world's most ubiquitous consumer products, one of the world's most profitable consumer products for a company like Apple, and Arm has an effective monopoly in the chips design for this space, yeah. which is really quite remarkable and a testament to the endurance of a technology that was born in fairly humble beginnings 3 decades ago. And that's both a huge boon to them, but it's also the biggest challenge for them to present a growth story to prospective investors in the stock market listing, because the smartphone market is not growing right now.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit hard to see where they can grow from 99%.
Yeah.
And
how are they doing financially right now?
So the revenues are basically flat year on year. And in the most recent quarter, actually profits were down by about 50%. So it's for a company that's trying to list, with revenues of $2.7 billion in the year to March at a prospective valuation of $50 to $60 billion. That's quite a big ask when you're not showing any growth.
With such a massive market share and yet not necessarily blowing people out of the park with their financial performance, what's happening? What's going on with their business model that this is the case?
So they do address this 99% in the document. And I would say to fill in those intervening years, which might be helpful. I mean, the company is founded, basically had two end customers. One of them was Apple, one of them was Acorn. And the management that led the company realized pretty quickly, this is a venture that's going to run out of money and we can't just serve two customers. So they went out looking for all these new markets. And the one that really cracked open for them was feature phones, I suppose we call them, or dumb phones. So the relationship with Nokia, which began about 1994 and led to a phone being launched in 1997, which is the Nokia 6110. I hate to give all the logs. It's the first one with a snake in it, basically. If you remember that was an absolute game changer for them, and that is the growth on the back of which they floated in 1998. And then to go out, so they've always been the smartphone company. They went from dumb phone to smartphone, and since then, other areas they talk about in the IPO document. Now they're in cars, because cars need assisted driving. Cars are computers. Yeah. On wheels, essentially. They're in a lot of comms infrastructure. They're in the data centers and all sorts of areas. So in terms of growth opportunities, they actually say we have got 99% of smartphones, but quite a big chunk of that should carry on growing, they think, at 6 to 7%, because you need more chips in more advanced devices. If you have more 5G, if you have more mobile gaming and so on. Yeah. Is one route. And then the other thing, just to say, they said slightly smaller market, but with data centers and with automotive, they think that's growing at 15% a year. Their share in data centers is 10%. So there is a bit of growth. I'm not here to sell Arm shares, by the way. I'd much rather sell Arm books.
But what's distinctive about the Arm technology is that it's very power efficient. And that's what made it popular for the Nokia phones, because they were battery powered in a way that the kind of Intel chips that were designed for a plugged in PC and server data center technologies never was. Everybody wants lower power, especially when you've got these huge cloud computing clusters that are run by Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook. Anytime you can squeeze power efficiency from that kind of infrastructure, you save a lot of money and ultimately you generate less carbon in the process. And so there's a huge incentive on those kinds of companies to do so. And Arm is providing one way of doing that. After a long time of trying fairly unsuccessfully, I think, to get into that market, they are now showing significant traction, particularly with Amazon and AWS. But so, yeah, I'm not trying to say that there's not growth potential in that business, but because so much of their revenues are dominated by the smartphone market, which at present is going down, it just happens to be a fairly poor time for their financial health to be trying to pitch that to investors. They can try and spin a growth story that may well come true, but it's not like they're coming out doubling year on year.
No,
like
you're right.
A racy new tech startup.
You absolutely. This is not the year to float normally, given those numbers. But there are various reasons why they need to get the shares on the market now. Not least, SoftBank needs a hit.
Well, yeah. So do we want to go into the SoftBank story yet? Or
well, I actually wanted to bring up too, just the whole idea around, there's been so much excitement around artificial intelligence, NVIDIA. What is Arm trying to do there? I mean, can they capitalize on this market?
Arm is trying to associate itself with artificial intelligence as much as it can, I think, Tim, isn't it?
It's trying.
Yeah, it's trying. And I think, I think the distinction is, it does say that there are things it can do around artificial intelligence and machine learning, but fundamentally, the chips that it specializes in, the CPU, which is, as I call it, the brains of the outfit, the controllers, is a very different type of machine to the GPU, the graphics processing unit, which is much better at doing lots of things in parallel, which is what NVIDIA are specialists in and what is powering AI. So that's a bit of a hard sell.
It is. I mean, they have a role to play in areas of AI that are not ChatGPT and the large language models that are receiving, you know, OpenAI being the canonical example that they're receiving so much hype and excitement at the moment. They play a role in autonomous car systems and this kind of sensing systems that you see there. So there is an AI component to them. It's just not the AI component that everyone's very excited about right now. And that may be fine in the long term.
Do you see a future for?
Well, where they do play a role is they have a. It's funny, there's a kind of role reversal in their relationship with NVIDIA. In the iPhone, the CPU that James describes that they design is the main brain of the device. For the kinds of AI computers that use NVIDIA's chips, it's NVIDIA that's the kind of main event, and ARM plays a supporting role. But it is there, and NVIDIA is integrating it into some of their supercomputer chips called the Grace Hopper. And so they're there. They're just not going to get anything like the kind of market share or therefore royalties that they've got from smartphones for the last decade or more.
Yeah, and I mean, ARM is also kind of in this place of, even if they wanted to maybe go down that path, wouldn't they then be competing with NVIDIA, which is one of their customers? I mean, how do they navigate that?
Well, the ARM model is kind of the I think they said this before, but I've certainly said it a lot and written it a lot. The Switzerland of semiconductors. You know, they work with the one of the secrets to ARM is that they work with everyone. So there's more than 1,000 partners that they would work with, and they don't give preferential treatment to one over another, which is why their potential acquisition by NVIDIA was seen as so controversial, and a lot of those other players that we talked about complained to the FTC, and the deal was never going to happen. I think one of the issues in that area is whether they're into AI, you know, or not, and there is that they just don't make very much money, and actually they are used 30 billion times a year. Every time there's a device that's shipped with one of their designs in them, they get a handful of cents. But the challenge for them is to turn that ubiquity into greater profitability. And you've got to imagine, I think, as they're on that roadshow now, that's got to be the sell to the potential investors. We've got this wonderful base. We're just going to get the margins up. But that's quite a difficult conversation when you're talking to someone like Apple, isn't it?
I mean, Apple more than almost anybody is one of the hardest negotiators in the tech business. And the relationship with Apple is odd because they are, by volume, one of their biggest customers. But because ARM strikes different licensing agreements with different kinds of customers and actually has a very long-standing licensing agreement with Apple, and Apple does a lot more work to design its own chips than, say, a Chinese handset manufacturer might, they actually get much less of a royalty out of Apple for all of the premium pricing of an iPhone than they would out of an Oppo or a Vivo or a Xiaomi that sold at a much lower cost. And so there are ways of upselling within that business, and there are many more customers that are trying to take different kinds of licenses where. And even potentially to allow ARM to produce chips for them in part. And they are trying to find ways to renegotiate those terms as they go along. But because they're struck over 5+ years in many cases, it's quite a slow process to kind of move that number up. Is it something like 1.7% overall was, I think, the number at their sort of...
Yes, or I remember, don't quote me on this, but something like 11 cents on average per royalty or something.
It's a very, very small amount.
It's what Google called the toothbrush industry, isn't it? You sell lots of little things and no one notices paying a small amount.
So we've been talking, I mean, it's an exciting time for the markets overall. It could spur a lot of other IPOs to follow. But at the same time, you're saying it could maybe not be the right time for Arm to list. So why is Arm listing now?
Because it's the right time for SoftBank, I think.
And why is it the right time for SoftBank?
So SoftBank bought them for $32 billion in 2016, very, very soon after the Brexit vote, and was hailed by the UK government as a great vote of confidence in Brexit Britain at the time, taking one of the crown jewels of British technology out of the public London markets and into private Japanese ownership. Make of that what you will. But the SoftBank has also made a lot of other investments over the intervening years, particularly through its Vision Fund, which put a lot of very big checks into a lot of very early stage startups, some of which have gone on to be quite big businesses like Uber, and some of which have gone on to be WeWork. And quite a lot of them have gone more the way of WeWork or in that direction than growing growing the value of their investment.
And so which one is Arm?
Well, I mean, we will find out when they list. But the, I mean, if they get it away at a $50 billion valuation, as is being, you know, the latest kind of mooted number, then they're on a $32 billion price. That's pretty decent. But they need to not only get some proceeds, because Arm won't actually make any money itself from this IPO. SoftBank will make several billion dollars in proceeds by selling down its stake. But it can also then borrow against it more easily because it will be a more liquid asset. It can sell down that stake in the coming years, ideally in such a way that doesn't tank the share price by putting too many shares on the market at one time. And it enables SoftBank to then go on what SoftBank's founder Masayoshi-san has called the counteroffensive after a rather defensive couple of years.
And we should say, I mean, I would say this is my view, you know, SoftBank is portrayed as this wonderful tech innovator, and you could argue that. You could also also argue it's quite a financial engineer. You know, Masayoshi-san is a magpie investor. He likes shiny things. He buys lots of things. There was a lot of concern among investors in 2016 before SoftBank bought Arm that SoftBank was overborrowed, and just a couple of weeks before it launched its bid for Arm, it sold its big investment in Supercell, the Finnish computer games company best known for Clash of the Clans. And I think a lot of the messaging around the time was, this is all about capital discipline. 3 weeks later, $32 billion for Arm.
And many people are expecting that there might be something similar brewing right now, that SoftBank will have maybe $50 billion to play with, and once this deal is done, both in terms of the cash it's already got, the proceeds it'll get, the borrowing it can then take out, and that's enough to, you know, pick up a couple of shiny new things.
Yeah, I know one other thing with looking through the F1 filing that was covered quite a bit in the FT was Arm's exposure to China. Tim, I wonder if you might want to explain what that is and what the risks or concerns are around.
I'm glad Tim's answering that one.
I will explain it as best I can, but it is, there are some conflicting accounts of what is going on mm-hmm. with Arm's China business. And even when you take Arm's word for it, it's still a little bit confusing. So Arm, under SoftBank ownership, set up a new entity called Arm China, I think in 2017, 2018, where it formed a joint venture with local Chinese investors, as is often the case with companies that do a significant amount of business in China, and Arm, many of its biggest customers are Chinese, both the smartphone companies and the big cloud computing providers, Alibaba, Tencent. And so whether that was just good politics or another piece of financial engineering by SoftBank or something else, I've never fully understood the logic for them going through with that transaction. But it meant that they were no longer 100% in control of, well, they were only 50% in control of that business. And then there was a very curious interlude where the CEO of Arm China, Alan Wu, tried to make off with
the chop
Can we? Yes, the chop, which is the item which bestows ownership and control of the business of that company. And there have been many, many lawsuits to try and win back control of it, which are so far going in Arm and SoftBank's favor, but they are still on appeal. And then at the end of, we're not even quite at the end of that process, but we are now left with a company in Arm China that is responsible for about a quarter of Arm's total group revenues, but which Arm's management has neither direct control or ownership or even kind of management board oversight of.
Yeah.
And so it has to sort of take Arm China's word for what Arm China's revenues are, and it warns in the filing that it has on occasion, you know, not been what's the phrase that they use? I can't find it in my notes. In the past, we have had issues obtaining timely and accurate information from Arm China. We believe the underlying problems causing our past inability to obtain such information have been resolved. But we can provide no assurances that our access to Arm China's records will not be inhibited again in the future. Is that something that you as a prospective investor would like to see in a business that's responsible for 25% of your company revenues, I guess is a question.
That was
may
my
come
question.
Up on the roadshow.
What should investors, how should investors think about that? I mean,
they should think very hard about it, yeah. I suspect.
But then you get so many of these warnings about China, and let's be clear. I mean, that situation in China has been rumbling on for 3 years. So it's not a new thing, and it's far from being resolved. And of course, we talk about the issues with Arm China, and that means we don't have quite as much time to talk about the fact that Arm is suing one of its biggest companies, Qualcomm, for alleged license breaches. So that's quite a risky thing to do when you're trying to raise a $60 billion valuation.
Sure, and then there's the whole business of the US-China chip trade war and lots of sanctions going on there. They're not quite as hard in the firing line as a company like Nvidia, but they might be. There's quite a lot of uncertainties in the risk factors. They may not be new news to people who've been paying attention to SoftBank's filings for a number of years and dealings with Arm while it's been under their ownership. But it you know, it's something that a more shall we say conventional fund manager than Masayoshi Son might want to think twice about.
If you were cynical, you might say this is why the company needs 28 banks to help it get off well.
Yes. So. We should point out also that this is not the first time that Arm has been publicly listed. It was listed for the first time in 1998. And at the time, it was a dual listing both in New York and in London. This time, it is now only listing in New York. Obviously, this was just a long time ago. Many differences in their business and everything. But I wonder if you might kind of want to compare and contrast what are the biggest differences, similarities that you see? Do you see any similarities to the situation that Arm is in then versus now?
Or? I mean, it's a different business. I mean, the big thing they were selling off the back of in 98 was the Nokia phone was selling, and that Nokia phone was so important to them that the Robin Saxby, who was the CEO at the time, spoke to the CEO of Nokia and said, "Look, do you mind if we take a picture of this handset to put it in?" The prospectus, because the investment bankers wanted a bit more sizzle. And because there was that imbalance between mobile telephony between the US and Europe was well ahead at the time. These were these, you know, beautiful little candy bar phones. The US fund managers loved it. They couldn't believe it was, you know, so much sleeker than the Motorola at the time. I suppose then you could see there was potential and there was growth. And in mobile, of course, you couldn't imagine that there would be quite that growth, because there was the switch from feature to smartphone and, you know, and also many, many more ARM licenses per handset in a smartphone than a feature phone. I think there was also other competitors around at the time. I mean, there were other similar architecture companies. MIPS was one that kind of traced its heritage back to Stanford University. And so it wasn't absolutely clear that Arm was the number one. Whereas you look at now, they're talking, there's a great phrase in the prospectus. I think they describe themselves now as the brain of everything, which I would have considered as the book title, but thought, no, I can't use that. So they're now the brain of everything. So they've kind of won the market, and that's why they have this challenge about, you know, where do they get the growth from?
I mean, 1998 was, you know, right in the sort of warming up period of the dot-com boom, dot-com bubble. And the whole of the, as James said, the whole of the smartphone, the mobile industry, not just the smartphone, but the whole of the mobile industry growth was ahead of it. We are now immediately off the back of the latest big smartphone, internet boom and bust.
Yeah. I think we saw
in this kind of accelerated pace over COVID. There was just huge amounts of money coming into the space, which is now really struggling to find a way out. And you know, substantially all of the growth in the smartphone market is behind them.
Yeah.
So well, I think it's that simple.
Yeah. To contrast, I know we were talking about earlier just that, as you said, there was a photo of the Nokia phone in their listing back then. This time, how many times is Apple listed in the F1 even mentioned?
Apple's only mentioned four times. I mean, they're maybe a bit shy about it.
Apple suppliers have quite a long and venerable relationship of not being able to mention their largest customer.
Okay.
They often talk on their earnings calls about our largest customer without actually naming Apple. Everyone knows that it's Apple. Okay. The analysts know that it's Apple. The investors know that it's Apple. But it's sort of he who shall not be named.
And there was a point that which I cover in the book at which Arm was really concerned. There was a time in the noughties where we talked about Intel. You know, Intel was and is the great chip provider to the PC market. Great when products were plugged in particular, because it didn't have the power efficiency of Arm, and it was trying to catch up in mobile. Such a charm offensive with Apple. It was providing chips to the Macs. I think it was Paul Ottolini who emerged onto the stage in the dry ice with his bunny suit on at one of the Steve Jobs presentations to give him the chip. And there was a point at which Arm was so unclear about Apple's next direction, going into a conference call, they thought this was the moment they were getting the kiss off. Intel had bought the business. And actually, that was the point when Apple said, no, we want a deeper business with you. We just want to work with you. So I think Apple keeps even its closest suppliers guessing.
Yes, very much so. But it's also because, I mean, Apple is one of the world's best chip designers, and it needs Arm less than many of Arm's other customers. And so I think in many ways, Arm would rather talk about some of its Chinese customers, despite the risks that come along with that, than they would about Apple.
And I think that's worth pointing out that the industry kind of changed a bit about 15 years ago, and Apple, you know, led that change. These big tech companies realized that rather than buying chips off the shelf or from Intel or from other people to get the precise specifications they wanted, because performance was so important, chips were too important to leave to the chip companies. So Apple built a custom chip business. I mean, there's more than 4,000 chip engineers within Apple. I forget the stat exactly, but if that division was a freestanding chip company, it might be the third biggest in the world. And so what they need, as you say, that the relationship with Arm changed a bit. They need the floor plan, but they're very comfortable in building on top of it themselves now.
So this listing is happening very soon. Tim, what will you be watching for, you and the rest of our colleagues?
Well, I think Arm's shares popped, 46% on their first day of trading in 1998. So, I mean, I'd be interested to see how it compares to that. I mean, there's certainly a lot of appetite among investors for a big new listing. There's been pent-up demand on that basis, but for all of the reasons we've discussed, there may also be caution. It's very hard to see what will happen. But beyond just the share price going up or down on day one, I remember Facebook's share price was, you know, basically flat on day one and ended up doing okay. So we shouldn't over-index on these things on the first day of trading. But there's also the question of whether some of those big customers that we've talked about come in as anchor investors in the IPO. I mean, I think it's looking extremely likely that Apple, Intel, Nvidia, Samsung will be among those first investors. It's not totally clear what they will be getting for that or how big a stake they will be getting. But to James's point earlier, it's in everybody in the industry's interest for Arm to remain somewhat neutral.
And that's why those investors are coming in, if only
to prevent somebody like Nvidia coming along and buying it up as a public company.
But that, I think that could potentially put a floor. I mean, I'd love to see a 48% pop based on a 50 billion, but I'm sure that won't be happening. But I think it's interesting to get those cornerstone investors in, Tim, but I just wonder, they've got 1,000 partners. So you're automatically, you haven't got one NVIDIA buying the whole shebang, but you have automatically created the premier level, if you like. So, you know, what do you say to those partners that haven't got the equity, but you're still working with? So it's, I think it's quite interesting how all of those relationships develop as they try and drive up the royalties as well.
And as we're speaking now, they haven't explained about how any of that will work. There's nothing in the filings about anchor investors or strategic investors.
I think one thing to say that's because you asked me about 2023 versus 1998. I mean, in 1998, there were, so I should say, so Arm began in a barn 8 miles west of Cambridge in 1990. And the people that started it were the bare minimum of people they thought were needed to make this company work. It wasn't, and actually the people who had the families and the mortgages thought the better option was to stick with Acorn because that was less risky. But the guys, and they were all guys that went into the Arm venture, a lot of uncertainty. They were pretty much all millionaires as of end of April 1998. There were 30 millionaires created almost immediately in Arm. And I think you will see potentially the cars in the car park getting a little bit bigger, you know, once again, when the shares list this time. Not just in Cambridge, still almost half the staff in Cambridge, but also over on the West Coast.
Got it. Well, with that, we're close to our time. Behind the Money is hosted by me, Michaela Tendera. Safia Ahmed is our producer. Topher Forges is our executive producer. Sound design and mixing by Sam Giovinco. Our intern is Monique Malima. Cheryl Brumley is the global head of audio. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.